Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Ranking of the Stars, a podcast in which I, Jack Dielobobolic, and my lovely, luscious, lean on me.
Okay, I didn't see that one coming. Hi, I'm Emmeline Dielobobolic.
Watch in chronological order every single movie that has won the Oscar for Best Picture. This week's movie is...
A Man for All Seasons.
Alternate title, Sign the Damn Paper, Thomas. This poster's all right.
Yeah.
It's the first time in a long time that I haven't been spoiled on the poster before we actually started the podcast.
Yeah. That's yellow background with the black shape of Sir Thomas More.
The silhouette of the man for all seasons. And we've seen posters that have these little, like, shaded heads before.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember what movie. Probably a Gigi or... No, Gigi was the It poster. Or maybe an American in Paris. One of those fucking musicals did this. I might choose a different color than this yellow, but a minor quibble.
Yeah.
I am picking nits.
I don't know what other color I would have in this background, though. Like
a blue? A blue would work nice?
Maybe. Yeah, I guess.
A blue or a red?
I guess. Yeah, overall, you know, it's not the worst. No.
A solid 7 out of 10.
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with that. Let's go to information about the movie.
Yep.
This movie is described as a British historical drama film about Sir Thomas More, who was a Lord Chancellor during the reign of King Henry VIII.
We're still in Europe.
We're still in Europe.
All the flights have been canceled. We're stuck.
1966, and we haven't moved any bit closer to coming back to the United States for those movies.
We have not been in America in over half a decade at this point.
Yep. Like we said, nothing happening in America in the 60s.
Nope.
I don't want to give too much away, but let's say that Thomas More was... not amongst the king's favorite people.
He was for a while, but all the high-ups in this era, he eventually falls out of favor.
Yeah, once you don't do what the king wants, then... Something that's never made really explicit in the movie is that it covers a period of time that spans from 1529 to 1535.
Yeah, you never get any locations or dates or anything.
No.
You just get thrown in and deal with it.
Yep. It was adapted from a 1960 play by Robert Bolt, who also wrote the screenplay for this movie on his own. The movie was directed by Fred Zinman. It was produced by Highland Films and distributed by Columbia Pictures. The movie was released on December 12th, 1966 in the United States. But it was only released in March 1967 in the UK. The running time is 120 minutes. The budget at the time was about $2 million. And it made over $28.4 million.
Sheesh.
Yeah, I would not have thought that it would have made that much.
No.
But
also, I have read a book about Sir Thomas More called Wolf Hall.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew...
You knew what would happen.
I knew, yeah, what was going to... There was no tension in this movie because I knew going in what was going to... The ultimate fate of everyone.
The only people I knew really in the movie were Henry VIII, obviously, Anne Boleyn, and Cromwell.
Cromwell. Yep.
All right. Characters and actors. We have Paul Scofield as Sir Thomas More.
One of the best poker faces I've ever seen.
Yeah.
He is just stone-faced throughout this entire movie.
Nothing moves him.
Nope.
We have Wendy Hiller, who plays his wife, Lady Alice More.
Who I believe is his second wife. Because there's a lot of detail you don't get in this movie that I only know because I read Wolf Hall.
Mm-hmm.
He had a whole first wife and daughter who died from some illness that never, ever gets mentioned in the movie.
Oh.
Yep.
Okay. We have Susanna York, who was also the young love interest in Tom Jones.
Really?
Yeah, she plays the daughter here, Margaret Moore.
Huh. Did not recognize her.
I knew I had seen her before, and I recognized the name. I had to look up through the different movies we watched to recognize which one she was in.
I did my best to completely wipe all memory of Tom Jones from my mind. Does not deserve a single neuron.
We have Orson Welles, who plays Cardinal Wolsey. Robert Shaw.
That was Orson Welles?
Yeah.
Holy shit. I did not recognize him at all.
Me neither.
He was in his girthy stage.
Yeah.
A mountain of a man.
Yeah. We have Robert Shaw, who plays King Henry VIII. Nigel Davenport plays the Duke of Norfolk.
Worcestershire.
Norfolk, as it's written. John Hurt plays Richard Rich.
Richie Rich.
Richie Rich. And Jack Gwilym plays Chief Justice.
Chief Justice. Is that one of the red-robed wizards at the end?
It's the guy at the head of the trial.
Yeah, those motherfuckers in their red snuggies.
Yep.
Yep, doing the Lord's work.
Doing the king's work.
Yep. Same thing.
Same thing. In this movie. Okay, there were some minor changes made here and there for the movie, but otherwise the movie is pretty faithful to the content of the play. Originally, the producers were afraid that Scofield was not well known enough by audiences, so they thought that he wouldn't draw people to the theaters.
He doesn't have the star power.
And so actors like Richard Burton and Laurence Olivier were approached to play the part of Moore.
Oh, God.
Imagine Laurence Olivier in this movie. Fuck no. As we say in French, I would rather go and dip my ass in cold water than watch this.
Does not Yong King look like a camel? Laurence, please.
Laurence.
Laurence.
Go away.
Do not censor my art, peasants.
All right. But the director insisted that he wanted Scofield, and thank God.
Marlon Brando was also there.
He was not listed on in here.
He provided catering.
He could not do the accent, that's yep. why. In order to keep a pretty tight budget, all the actors took some pay cuts. Only Scofield, York, and Wells were paid more than 10,000 British pounds for the movie.
10,000 doll hairs.
Yep. It seems like the movie was a really big critical success at the time, with people really praising Scofield's performance.
It was a good performance.
Yeah, he's a really good actor.
He knows how to orate.
He was a really good actor. And so good that in 1995, the Vatican put A Man for All Seasons on their list of the greatest movies of all time.
The Pope loves it.
The Pope.
His hat, yes. His big fancy hat flew right off his big fancy head.
The movie was nominated for 8 Academy Awards, including Best Supporting Actor for Robert Shaw.
Who's that? Is that Cromwell?
Robert Shaw. No, that's King Henry VIII. Yeah. He's barely in the movie.
Yeah.
I mean, so it was also nominated for Best Supporting Actress for Wendy Hiller, who was Alice Moore, and she's also barely in the movie. I don't understand this. And
Cromwell was way better than the king.
Yes, absolutely. He's an asshole, but the actor was way better than the king.
Yeah, he had a really great voice. He jowly, but he, like, clicks a lot.
And had a voice that's like that fits the character.
Yes, a bulbous nose and like sausage fingers and like, are you telling me, Sir Thomas? It's very very pronounced enunciations on everything.
Yeah.
That you will not kneel to the king.
All right, stop making me laugh. We're not gonna get through this episode otherwise. It won 6 of the nominations for Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor for Paul Scofield, Best Screenplay based on material from another medium, Best Cinematography and Color.
I don't know about that.
And Best Costume Design and Color.
Cinematography, I guess. I mean, what did they do in this? There was they showed a lot of what, statues and crap. I don't buy it.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot of innovation.
No.
But it's also, at the same time, it's well edited.
It's competent.
It's competent, exactly. Yeah. It didn't fuck up. That deserves something. And finally, the loser's bracket of 1966 includes Alfie. The Russians are coming! The Russians are coming!
Run and tell the president!
The Sand Pebbles. And Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
I mean, gotta go with the Russians on that one.
Yeah, that's the only thing that sounds remotely interesting and entertaining.
Those Russians.
And with that, that's all you.
The synopsis, which I will tell you, audience, it might be the shortest synopsis I have ever done for a movie. This movie is very straightforward. There's just not a whole lot of twists and turns or things going on.
The scenes can drag sometimes, but yeah, not a whole lot happens.
There's a lot of pontificating that I did not include in the synopsis.
Yeah.
But we'll flesh it out a little bit. We open with a series of static shots of statues, and then a close-up of the chain of office for the Cardinal. We get their statues like dogs and gargoyles, and they do one in particular with a thing that happens in real life that you almost never ever see in movies or TV or anything. It's when there's a like pitch black sky, but somehow the sunlight's still getting through, so it's completely dark in the sky, but the objects on the ground are still illuminated.
Mm-hmm.
Really beautiful, and you almost never see it
in
visual mediums. A shame. And then a close-up shot of the chain of office for the Lord Chancellor, which the Cardinal is wearing. It's these big golden S's that are all linked together in a chain, and then culminating in a big-ass, like, sun-looking medallion.
Mm-hmm.
The camera pans down, and we see he is writing a letter with quill and ink. He finishes it, folds it, pours some hot wax on it, and then presses his seal into the wax. This is an official missive.
Yep.
The message is then taken out of the office by Cromwell and given to a messenger. We follow the messenger as he runs out of the castle and gets into a small boat, and then get the opening credits as the boat ferries him down the river, and we get some beautiful sunset shots as he moves. There's a lot of boat travel in this movie. I don't know, do you know what river they're on? I got no fucking idea.
I have no idea.
But in order to get to the king's castle, you have to go by a little boat. The boat finally pulls up to a tiny dock, and the messenger runs up to a massive estate, handing the letter off to the house servant Matthew, who tries to peek at the contents before delivering it to his master, Sir Thomas More, who is in the middle of entertaining guests. They're talking about, like, pious priests in England and how hard it is to find them. Oh, but there's one we know, but he's a simpleton. Yuck, yuck, yuck.
They're also talking about the fact that a lot of children are being fathered by, what's the word?
Priests.
By priests.
Yep.
Yep.
Yep, they're up to funny business.
Yep.
Always have been, always will. Thomas reads the note. He asks Matthew what the note says and talks about, I don't know, I didn't snoop, what are you talking about?
Like anything interesting?
Yep, I would not know, my lord. Thomas reads it and then informs his guests that the message is from Cardinal Wolsey, who has summoned him for an audience. For what, they ask? The king's business, he says. More like the queen's business, says Thomas's wife. Well, it's all the cardinal's business, Thomas replies as he puts the letter in the open fireplace. And when the cardinal calls, you all come running day or night, says the duke. What is the man? A butcher's son. Bah! A younger man rises from his seat and says that surely when a man rises so high and so swiftly, they must think he was misplaced in his origins. That at least was the opinion of Aristotle, he mumbles as he's met with blank stares. This is Richie Rich, mm-hmm. who looks like he belongs in either a 70s rock band or a pornography.
I would have put him like... And I could have seen him as like a gang member in like West Side Story or in like, I don't know. He looks like he could be in a gang.
If he were, he would be way in the back. He would not be one of the main characters.
Sure. He's a scrawny little man.
He does the thing that always freaks me out where he has the face of a 12-year-old, but like a full bushy mustache. And like bowl cut for a haircut. Yeah, it's not great. It's very 70s look. How did this child get a mustache? a butcher's son, and he looks it, shoots back the Duke. No one is impressed with Richie Rich's quoting Aristotle. Thomas says he'll be back for breakfast, and then he leads his family in prayer before he leaves. As he leaves, the Duke warns him to be careful about the Cardinal. He's a frightened man. The young man follows Thomas out and asks if Thomas recommended him to the Duke. No, says Thomas, but he might have a position for him. He'll tell him about it tomorrow. Then we watch Thomas ride in a small boat, then tip the boatman, then walk up towards the palace, then be announced to the Cardinal by Cromwell, who leaves but stands right outside the door to eavesdrop on the conversation. It's all backstabbing and politicking.
Yeah. It's all about, you know, knowing what other people are thinking and saying so that you can use it to your advantage.
Yeah, blackmail and backstabbing and wheeling and dealing, and no one's ever content with anything, and we all just have to climb ever higher and get as close to the king as possible.
Yeah.
You opposed me in the council this morning, Thomas, says the Cardinal without looking up from the papers in front of him. Yes, Your Grace. You were the only one. Yes, Your Grace. You're a fool. Thank God there is only one fool on the council, says Thomas. Why did you oppose me? I thought Your Grace was wrong. You're a constant regret to me, Thomas. If you could only see matters flat on without that horrible moral squint. If you could only be more corrupt, you piece of shit. Trumpets then sound outside. This is nighttime, we should say. And they say before Thomas leaves, his wife's like, you're not even gonna get there by midnight. Why is he calling you so late? So it's dark outside, but then trumpets sound and the Cardinal moves to the window to watch the king returning. He tells Thomas that the king has been out playing in the muck again. He's been to Mistress Anne Boleyn.
Anne Boleyn.
She's bowling. Anne Bowling Lane. Got it. He sits heavily back into his chair and asks if Thomas is going to help him. The king wants a son. What is Thomas going to do about it? Well, seeing as I'm not a lady...
Nothing to do about it.
No. Thomas doesn't think the king needs advice on how to do that. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. The Cardinal leans forward and gives Thomas his word that they're alone so Thomas can speak freely. You think the Cardinal knows that Cromwell's eavesdropping? Is he lying?
He knows. Yeah. He knows Cromwell is a piece of shit.
Everyone's crooked as sin in this. Thomas says he didn't think there was anyone who was listening. The Cardinal then says that his goal is to secure a divorce for the king so he can marry his mistress and get an heir, because his current wife, and I quote, is barren as a brick. Will Thomas support him? Thomas will not.
Which isn't totally true, because if memory serves me well, the wife wasn't barren so much as she, I think, only had daughters or stillborn babies. So it's not that she was barren, it's just that she wasn't giving him a living heir.
Well, I mean, King Henry VIII notoriously also got several bricks pregnant, so...
Sure.
The metaphor holds.
Yes.
Thomas will not support him. It is against the church rules, and the Pope wouldn't like it. Thomas is a devout man of the Lord. The cardinal accuses him of putting his private conscience ahead of the well-being of England, and Thomas responds that statesmen that ignore their conscience quickly lead their nations into chaos. The cardinal says that makes them enemies and dismisses Thomas. As he leaves, he walks down a corridor lined with peasants who immediately swarm him to plead their cases, because Thomas is a lawyer, one going so far as to give him a silver chalice as a bribe, and another gives him a basket of baked apples. They all got these little slips of paper to hand him, and they all swarm him, oh, my case, and he takes the little slips of paper and he goes, I will read it. And then there's a noble who even tries to be like, oh, it's a very complicated matter, you see. And Thomas goes, I will read it, and takes it and walks away. And it's supposed to be after midnight. You think all these peasants would actually be in this place after midnight?
I honestly think so.
Really? That you gotta, like, sleep out in the corridor?
Yeah.
To get you secure your early position?
To get a chance to be heard.
Yeah. Jesus. So he gets a silver cup and some baked apples. Then we watch Thomas get back in the boat to head home. Time passes, and he wakes up when the silver chalice falls from his lap and thumps into the bottom of the boat. The boatman says it's a nice cup, and Thomas agrees, then stares at it for a few moments, and then chucks it into the water in disgust. Fuck this cup. The boatman scrambles to pull it out before it sinks and reproaches Thomas. That's worth money, sir! And I thought for sure that he was going to give it to the boatman.
Yeah, I thought so too. Because he looked like he respected the man.
Yeah, and I also don't understand if he's so disgusted with why he even took the bribe in the first place. But whatever. The boat then arrives at the tiny dock where Richard has been waiting all night.
I think on your comment about, you know, why did he take the cup in the first place, I think Thomas more is a character here that he's shown to be respectful of others, so he probably didn't want to show any disrespect to the person who gave him the cup.
The peasants. Yeah. He didn't want to call them out on bribing him.
Yeah.
Sure. So Richard just slept outside all night because he's that eager to get a position at court. He wants to know about that position. The position is at the new school, says Thomas, and Richard will get a house, a servant, and £50 a year. Not a bad deal.
At the time, no.
Nope. A teacher, says Richard, disappointment clear on his face. No one is going to give you a place at court, says Thomas. Cromwell said he would, says Richard. Well, if you know Cromwell, you don't need my help, replies Thomas. Richard then asks why Thomas doesn't think he should be at court, and Thomas pulls out the silver cup. He gives it to Richard to keep and tells him it's a bribe, and on the lower end of bribes that one gets at court. They will try and bribe you with anything from houses to coats of arms to estates to anything. One should not go where they are tempted, says Thomas. Why not be a teacher? He could be a great one. Because then who would know my name, says Richard. Your pupils, says Thomas, your friends. God, not a bad public. Richard then tries to ask questions about the divorce, and Thomas yells for the boatman to take Richard home.
Yeah, I understand the ambition, but also, like, who the fuck cares? Like, even if people know your name, like, that just, I don't know, to me that's just not a thing that matters.
Yeah, Richard's chasing the wrong dragon.
Of course.
And he even says, like, oh, it's easy for you to say that court isn't all that when you've just been to see the cardinal. And Thomas is like, yep, the cardinal. It sounds very glamorous, doesn't it? But the reality is much different.
Yeah, it's not all that.
Thomas then heads inside his manor to find his daughter hanging out with her boyfriend, Will, who asks for her hand in marriage. Thomas says no, and says the answer will never change so long as Will is a heretic. And Will's a heretic because he is a Lutheran. They split from the church. The church is corrupt. Petty religious squabbles.
It also sounds like, what's his name? Will has changed his mind a couple times about what brand of religion to
Yes.
follow. So.
Thomas says something along the lines of the direction of your face continues to waver or spin or something, and let us just pray, young Will, that when it finally rests, it will be pointed in the right direction.
Wow.
They argue about it a bit more, and then Thomas lets Will borrow a horse so he can get home. His daughter then asks what the cardinal wanted, and Thomas changes the subject. They head upstairs where they encounter his wife, who also asks what the cardinal wanted, and again Thomas changes the subject and tells her that Will wants to marry their daughter. This upsets his wife for some reason, and she goes to hit their daughter, but is caught by Thomas, who tells her that their daughter, Meg, is full of education and it's a delicate commodity. Why is she mad about this?
I think it's sort of implied that Will comes from a family of lawyers, but they're less established than the Moors.
Yeah, I guess it's a class thing.
Yeah.
Her response is like, "Oh, you wicked girl, how dare you?" And it's like, what are you getting mad about? What is all this? What nonsensical social rules she violated in 1500s England?
At this period of time, you should be happy if anybody wants to marry your daughter.
Of course, his wife is never happy about anything that happens in this movie. She has a very Ebenezer Scrooge mentality. She needs to be visited by the ghost of Christmas future. Spirit! Whose lonely grave is this? Then we cut to shots of bare tree branches silhouetted against a cold winter sky, then see riders on horseback appearing slowly out of a heavy fog, then riding over snowy hills. It's a very Lawrence of Arabia kind of shot, just
But in the snow.
but in the snow instead of, yeah, different kind of sand, different kind of dunes. Just the far back camera watching like small horses move across a barren landscape.
Yeah.
Then we jump to the cardinal on his deathbed as he's anointed by chanting monks. The Duke enters the room and takes the chain of office off a pillow and drapes it over his arm and asks if the cardinal has any message for His Majesty. If I had served God, croaks the cardinal, one half so well as I've served my king, God would not have let me die in this place. Thank God you're dying here, says the Duke. The king would have you die in the tower. And then he slams the door on the way out. I like the Duke. The Duke is very no-nonsense and just does not buy into. He's not interested in all the backstabbing and blackmail. He's just about enjoying his station and having a good time.
Yeah, he doesn't like people who are bullshitting.
Yeah. He's very straightforward and blunt, and I appreciate that. Then we cut to the coronation of Thomas as the new Lord Chancellor of the realm. He gets the heavy golden chain placed around his neck. And then the chain's placed around his neck, and trumpets blare. He's in court, and there's like official scroll read by a squire. And here ye, now new protector of the realm, loved by the king and all his people, Sir Thomas More. Here is the gold. Then we see three royal boats taking the king and his lackeys on a visit to Thomas's manor. These are decidedly more fancy looking than the small boats that Thomas rides in. They are white.
Yeah.
They have multiple dedicated oarsmen. There's a little a pavilion kind of covering over the king, so the
They're
sun.
royal boats.
Yes, the sun's rays do not touch him. He's surrounded by his giggling lackeys.
You see, like, bigger, obviously, like, way bigger versions of these boats still nowadays in England. I've seen those when it's not the Queen anymore, but when it was the Queen's birthday or the Queen's Jubilee. And the royals go on the Thames. They still have those kinds of boats.
Oh boy, they're still royal oarsmen.
Yeah.
Oh boy. That's a good use of everyone's time.
and money.
Yep. We then jump inside the manor to see Thomas's wife and all the servants, plus the Duke making sure all the food is set on the table. And then Matthew runs in a stammering panic, saying that the king is arriving. Oh, God. They've got, like, a whole-ass fish and a turkey. It's a whole feast set on...
But they knew that the king was going to come. Yes,
that was the conceit of this thing. Because, like, Thomas is standing out on the lawn waiting, and... They're supposed to pretend that this is a surprise visit, but they know in advance that he's coming, so they're all shitting themselves to get everything in perfect order.
Yeah.
The lady of the house rushes out to greet the king, and then we're treated to a short scene of the king jumping into the muddy shore and laughing. He doesn't dock his boat at the dock. He just is driven up onto shore, and then he jumps down into the mud, and you get this quick little scene where he's blank-faced at first, and then all his lackeys don't know how to respond, and then the king starts laughing, and then they go, oh, it's okay to laugh, and then they all start laughing. These people suck. They're just...
Can't laugh before the king does.
Nope, they're all just looking to him to know how to react to everything.
Yeah.
They're the most psychophantic brown nosers, just... Yep. No will of their own, just whatever the king says is supposed to happen, that's supposed to happen.
This is a time where disagreeing with the king could get you beheaded, so...
Yeah, but also you have to intentionally try to be part of that, of the court, right?
Sure.
It's their own damn fault. You don't just get sucked into the king's gravity by natural process. You have to choose to do it. As the family waits for the king to approach, Meg asks the Duke why the king is coming, to which the Duke replies he is coming for an answer about the divorce. Meg says he already has an answer, and the Duke says he wants a different one. Then the king greets the family and flirts with Meg a bit. He kneels down and he goes, oh, I've heard you're a bit of a scholar, Meg. And her response is, I pass for one as a woman, or something like that.
I pass for one amongst the women.
Yeah, and then he speaks to her in Latin, and she responds, and they go back and forth in Latin, and he turns away at some point, because her response is longer, and he's like, yeah, I get it.
I took that as she was probably speaking Latin way better than he did, and he didn't understand what she was saying, so he kind of, like, took himself out of the conversation.
Probably, and then he makes her look at his legs, he's like, these are a dancer's legs, Meg! The king, as most kings are, is a fucking lunatic. And then he's like, do you like music? I'll play you some of my music.
He's a skirt chaser.
Yep. And then he goes on a stroll with Thomas alone to talk about the divorce. Thomas still won't support it. They have a long, drawn-out conversation about this. I am abridging this for all our sanity. And the king yells at him and leaves before even going in the house. One of the things that Thomas says is he doesn't think the divorce is a good idea, and then the king's response to that is, then you haven't thought about it enough! And he's almost, like, schizophrenic in this scene, because his emotions are just all over the place. He'll go from yelling and screaming one second to literally the next thing out of his mouth being like, oh, these are such beautiful flowers you have on your tree. And then, like... I respect you, Thomas, because you're an honest man, but anyone who goes against a divorce is a traitor! And it's just oscillates back and forth between that. You can tell from the look on Thomas's face, like, he's a little taken aback by this. He's like, oh, like, he didn't fully know what a lunatic the king was until this point.
He doesn't know when to talk also, because the king just, like, rambles on. There's no way to interrupt. There's no way to, like, give an answer that would be satisfactory to stop the madness or anything. It just, the only thing you can do is, like, sit there and wait for it to pass.
Yes, you are at the mercy of a petulant, temperamental child. You can tell he understands what a tightrope he's walking, where he is very carefully choosing every single word he says. Yeah. Whereas the king is just, he's like ranting and raving and then being cordial and then yelling and then like pacing around and just being nuts. Just, he's yelling so loud that the camera cuts inside the house and everyone is just looking at the window and listening to the king's scream.
The windows are open too.
Yep. So everyone, no one's talking to each other. They're all just stone silent, just staring like pale faced at the window while the king screams at Thomas.
I think that, you know, in some of these moments, I feel like the king, you know, when he's looking at the flowers and stuff like that, talking about music, and it almost feels like he's trying to appear as a normal person.
He's trying to relate, yeah.
Yeah, he's trying to be relatable and trying to appear as a good normal person, but then everything else he does when he's screaming and just, you know, telling Moore that you can't go against the king.
Yeah, he's completely two-faced because he's trying to be chummy and like, oh, I'm your friend, and I'm so glad I made a chancellor who's a friend, and we're good pals. And then not 5 seconds later, he'll be like, and I am your king, and defying me is treachery. You can't have it both ways.
Nope.
And then he has this incredible line that just comes out of nowhere where he's talking about how Thomas asks why his opinion even matters to the king.
Mm-hmm.
And the king says, because you're an honest man. And there is a mass that will follow me because it follows anything that moves. And it was just like, holy shit, Henry. You need to warn me before you drop the entire weight of our species on my shoulders.
This is probably, like, this is one of the best lines we've heard in all these movies.
Yes, it is one of the most depressingly true things I have heard in quite a while.
Yes.
That there are millions upon millions of people that just have no will of their own.
And forget will, just thoughts. Like, there are millions and millions of people who just don't have thoughts of their own, who are just happy following what other people think and do.
Yes, the great mass, Thomas, that will think whatever they are told to think. Oh, man.
That was heavy.
Fucking bleak, Henry.
In the middle of a completely lunatic rant, that was, whew.
Yep. He just cut to the bone, just out of nowhere. I was not ready for that. We watched this movie, I think, over a week ago at this point. Yeah. I'm still recovering from that. and it's...
It took me by surprise, and I was... The rest of the movie, I was kind of waiting for, like, more truths like that to come out.
Yep. But that's the...
Because it was a complete surprise in this movie that otherwise felt kind of, like, normal or, like, banal, even.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you're hit with this, like, holy shit, okay, this could actually be a game changer.
Yeah, a lightning bolt out of the sky. And then at some point Thomas makes reference to the queen, and the king screams...
Screw your podcast, is what the king says. Hello, audience. So, for the first time ever, we are having to re-record some audio because, for some reason, the next 5 minutes or so got corrupted. Thank God we didn't lose the whole thing, but it was like interference where it sounded like the noise that happens when you rub a pen over paper really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And just that for 5 minutes, so... This is new audio we're having to re-record, and then we'll go back to the original audio. And also want to apologize for the slight hum on the audio as well. We're learning that our microphone is much more sensitive to positioning and echo, I guess. And in the future, we're going to try and record in a different room to avoid that.
Yes.
So what the king actually shouts is that he has no queen, and then everyone that says otherwise is a traitor.
And he says that he has no queen because... In his opinion, well, he married his brother's widow, and marrying his brother's widow, according to him, is sort of incestuous. So that's why he thinks that the current queen should be considered the queen.
And not just according to him, but according to the Lord as well. He quotes Leviticus. It says, yes, thou shalt not uncover the nakedness of the brother's wife. And then Thomas comes back with, yes, but Deuteronomy says, and the king cuts in and says, Deuteronomy is ambiguous.
Which, in the original segment of that, of the episode, I said, it's funny to me. It was really funny to me and ironic that for somebody who wants to be in charge of the church and doesn't respect the, you know, the rulings of the Pope and all that, doesn't seem to have much respect for religion. It was funny to me that he was quoting the Bible here to justify his case.
Yeah, you just got to know just enough to get your way.
Yeah.
That's the secret.
Yeah.
And once he says the line about people disagreeing about the queen being traitors, we cut back inside and everybody kind of raises their eyebrows at the traitor's word, like, oh, this is the first time it's been made official.
Yeah.
That this is a lethal offense to disagree about.
Yeah, everybody is, they're looking at each other like, oh, this is taking a new direction.
Yeah, king is mad. And then the king leaves without ever going inside to taste any of the food. He like smacks a branch on the way out. And then Thomas and his wife yell at each other. And she, why did you have to piss off the king, Thomas? You're such a fucking idiot. And Thomas says, mind your house, woman. And she, I am minding my house. And then the king doesn't wait for his lackeys when he leaves. He just jumps back into his boat and signals the oarmen to take off. And so the lackeys all have to run pell-mell out of the house to try and jump on the boat before it leaves, but they don't make it. So they just kind of stumble into the mud and then splash into the water while the king points and laughs at them.
Yep.
And I think that covers everything that got corrupted. So at this point, we will go back to the original audio. Thank you for listening. Sorry about all the audio screw-ups. We'll do better. I promise.
And they have to get into the water before they can get into the boat.
Yeah, and he's just a fucking child. It sucks.
I mean, aren't most kings just a bunch of children?
Yes. It's just having the ruler of your country be the bully from The Simpsons. Ha ha! He says as... It's like, oh my god, they're so fucked. And like, everyone around him has to pretend that he's like this divine, awesome person. And
yeah.
This system sucks. This whole thing sucks. How did this happen?
It happened because people were willing to follow.
Yeah. Then we rejoin Thomas as he sits at his table eating Jell-O. I didn't know they had Jell-O in the 1500s, but...
I mean, the like Jell-O part is made from like, it's made from a powder that kind of solidifies, but not all the way. So you could still have the powder in the 1500s.
I suppose it was lime green Jell-O though. Did they have food coloring in the 1500s?
I didn't leave in the 1500s, so I don't know. But I'm assuming that there was that there's ways to. Like, color food.
Yeah, I am no historian. This could be completely period accurate. It's just, Jell-O seems like a very modern thing to me, so it was very... It's like a record scratch seeing him eat it. Like, what? Huh? It's like if somebody just drove in a car during this. Then Meg and Will enter so Will can let Thomas know he's rethought his heretic opinions. Will then tries to talk shit about the king, and Thomas tells him that there are certain things he cannot hear because of his office. Then Matthew comes in to announce Richard, who warns Thomas about Cromwell. He's saying, Cromwell is asking questions about you. And he also accuses Matthew of being a spy, which that's why Matthew was trying to read that letter in the opening. He says Matthew's a spy. He asks Thomas for a job. Thomas says no. Richard then leaves, and Thomas's whole family starts yelling about that he's evil and should be arrested. I don't understand the antagonism towards Richard in the beginning. Like, he proves Thomas right later on that he's not to be trusted, but in the beginning, there's no real justification given for it, and they're all just super suspicious and aggressive towards him for seemingly no reason.
Yeah, I mean, what I told you at the end of the movie is I think that first impression that Rich makes when he's quoting Aristotle, it looks like when he's saying it, it sounds like he's believing it as if it was his own thought at first. But then he says, you know, this is what Aristotle said. I feel like just this very first scene it tells you everything you need to know about Rich, like that he doesn't have his own thoughts. He can only like be a part of the conversation by quoting other people. And Sir Thomas More is somebody who likes people to have their own opinions and have their own convictions.
Yeah, a strong character.
Yeah.
But Richard is part of that mass that will follow anything.
Exactly.
Yeah, in this scene, they're just... From the second he walks in, though, they're, like, very cold towards him.
Mm-hmm.
And he even commented, like, you're looking at me like I'm an enemy. Why are you looking at me like that? And then Thomas like, why are you shaking, Richard? And he pretty much begs for a position. It's like, please, give me a job. Please, please. And Thomas just, no. And then I think it's in this scene where he asks why, and Thomas's response is, because you can't even speak for yourself so far as tonight. Meaning Richard isn't on anyone's side. He just blows around with the wind, and he doesn't know whose side he'll be on even up to this very evening.
Yeah.
And then Richard leaves, and they're all like, he's evil, arrest him, forget him! Then it turns into a philosophical argument about the nature of law and how you should be able to just cut through the law. And then Thomas says circumventing the law leads to chaos, and he has this line about if you cut down all the laws, you'll be the next thing to be cut down.
Mm.
And the laws basically function as like a windbreak for chaos, because if you flatten the landscape by removing all the laws, the evil wind will blow and tear down everything.
Mm.
Fade to Richard selling out Thomas to Cromwell in exchange for a spot at court. So we see that Thomas was ultimately right, but I feel like Thomas pushed Richard into this. Because Richard even says when he's begging for a job, like, I would way rather be on your side, Thomas, than Cromwell. But it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy. Like, yes, he does betray Thomas, but he betrays Thomas because Thomas pushed him away, like, every opportunity he got.
Yeah, but who's to say also that even if Thomas had given him a job, that Rich wouldn't have turned on him anyway.
Yeah, you're right. We will never know. It's just...
There's always, especially because of the position that Thomas had as Lord Chancellor, there would always be people coming after him and trying to bribe his staff to see if he had any secrets, if he committed any wrongdoing or anything. So there would always be like some temptation outside of Thomas's house for Rich to fall for.
And Rich is weak to temptation.
Exactly.
Yep. And this is another scene I've abbreviated a lot, this talk between him and Cromwell, because Cromwell is like plying him for information and being like, well, what would you be willing to tell me? And Rich's first response is, oh, nothing that was said in confidence between friends. And then Cromwell goes, really? No, seriously, really? And he even says seriously, which sounded too modern for the time to my ears, but whatever. Then we jump to some sort of religious court. It's people in red robes, and they've got like crucifixes on staffs, and they're sitting in front of a golden crucifix with Jesus on the cross.
It's like the high court. Imagine this is the, you know, the 16th century equivalent of the Supreme Court.
Yeah, religious court. Where a herald of the king announces to the assembled men in funny hats and robes that the king has declared himself supreme head of the church in England. The Pope ain't shit. cut to Thomas resigning from his office. And the Duke taking his chain after Meg helps him take it off. He has his wife, Will, Meg, and the Duke. And he has some trouble getting...
It gets stuck somewhere in his clothing.
Or it's just a big, unwieldy thing, so he needs help taking off. And he's like, Duke, will you help me? And the Duke's like, no, I don't want any part of this. And then he turns to his wife, will you help me? She's mad because he's... giving up the office, so she won't help him. And then Will says, I'll do it. And Thomas is like, I don't like you that much. So he turns to Meg and he's like, will you help me with the chain, Meg? And Meg helps him with the chain. Will is also there, and he tries to shit-talk the king again. And again, Thomas tells him to shut the hell up and remember that he has a family now, and potentially children in the future. Will wants to be accused of treason so badly, but Thomas will just not let him do it. Fade to the Duke, and Thomas walking alone outside, and the Duke asking Thomas to help him understand, because to him, this looks like cowardice. Thomas replies that the king is fighting the Pope, who is the living link to Christ, and he has to be on the Lord's side. It is a matter of conscience, he says. The Duke tells him he's ill, and then we cut to a scene of Thomas dismissing his servants because he can't afford them anymore, but will find them all other places to work. I am no longer a great house, and so do not require servants. But I know other men who are in great houses and will require servants. And some of the servants start to cry, and I think Matthew speaks up and says, we're all on your side, Sir Thomas. And then Sir Thomas gets pissed and says, you don't know what my side is, and if you go around saying that, you're going to get me and everyone else in trouble, so shut the hell up. After the servants wander away, Matthew lingers, and Thomas says he will miss him. He asks him if he's going to stay on for reduced pay, and then Matthew quasi-admits to being a spy and says, oh, no, you see through me, my lord. Mm. But then Thomas says he will miss him anyway. Then Thomas leaves, and Matthew yells at who I guess is his wife and says, oh, it's very well and good to say you miss me, but will you work for half wages? I wish everyone was good, and I wish everyone was honorable, and I wish that it would rain a beer instead of water. And his wife is like, I didn't do this. Why are you yelling at me? And I think that's the last we ever see Matthew.
Yeah.
Then we get a scene of Thomas's wife asking what he'll do now. Thomas says he'll read, write, and learn to fish. This pisses his wife off, because everything pisses her off. And
yeah, she's never not pissed off.
No. And she pushes him to make an official statement, and she doesn't understand why he hasn't made an official statement, or at least told her about how he feels about all this. And then he has to explain to her, like, if I tell you what my actual opinions are, and they take you for questioning, and put you under oath, I know you, you're not gonna lie. So yeah. It's strategically better for everyone if you don't know this. And then she gets upset because she's like, oh, but I bet you tell Meg and not me. So you're jealous? That's the problem. Whatever. What is your problem?
You're jealous that your daughter is more intelligent?
Yeah. He asks her during the scene if she would like him to teach her how to read, and she declines.
Yeah.
So it's her own damn fault. Thomas refuses to make a statement, saying he has to remain silent not just for his sake, but for everyone's sake. If he's silent, they'll all be left alone. She'll see. Then we jump to the Duke in Cromwell's office, as the Duke says he doesn't agree with all this conspiracy, and they should just let sleeping dogs lie. This is a beautiful shot because it's winter, and you can just see the snow falling outside of the windows of Cromwell's office. The king doesn't think so, replies Cromwell as Richard enters the room. Cromwell then says they have a report of Thomas accepting bribes when he was a judge, and the Duke, enraged, pounds Cromwell's desk with his fist and says, God damn it, Thomas was the only judge that didn't accept bribes. And you know this. Nevertheless, says Cromwell, it could send him to the Tower. Then they bring in the woman who gave Thomas the silver cup and briefly interrogate her. The Duke is not impressed with her testimony, and Cromwell's an asshole towards her because she tries to be like, and my case I don't think was judged very well, and he's just like, shut up! That's enough! Be quiet! And then as soon as she makes her testimony, she's like, and I'd like to say something else. He's like, begone, wench! It's like, holy shit. Then Richard talks about getting the cup, and the Duke is still not impressed. He says, like, oh, so as soon as Thomas knew it was a bribe, he dumped it into the nearest gutter, and he looks at Richard. He tells them they'll never get Thomas on such flimsy charges, and starts putting on his coat to leave, but Cromwell stops him by telling him the king has requested that the Duke be an active part of pursuing charges against Thomas. By the king's decree, the Duke has to be part of it. though if Thomas were to attend the king's wedding, it would probably smooth things over. Then we see bells ringing all over England for the king's wedding day, and then go to the wedding proper. The duke gives the king a giant golden goblet, and then the king sings to his new bride. It's very reminiscent of Edelweiss, one of those slow romantic songs. I think it's about hunting.
Yeah.
Because he's going to hunt her vagoo, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Mm. And I think this is the only time we see Anne Bowling Lane. Not impressed.
Anne Boleyn.
That's what I said. Not impressed. All this over this lady?
Yeah.
Okay. That's the best you could... You're a fucking king? This is the best you could do? Okay. Okay, sure. Whatever. Then the king spots what he thinks is the back of Thomas's head and rushes over calling his name. Thomas! Thomas! He says. It's not Thomas, though, and we fade to a messenger arriving at Thomas's manor. He enters and finds Will and Meg and tells Meg that her father has been summoned to court to answer certain charges, he says. And we can see that the house has basically been gutted at this point.
Furniture is gone. Everything's gone.
Furniture's gone. It's the same room we saw that had the table prepared with the feast.
Yeah.
And now it's just completely barren and empty. And, yep. He is falling in his station in life. Cut to Thomas taking a seat in Cromwell's office and asking what the charges are. Cromwell says there are no charges, just certain ambiguities that the king would like cleared up. And Richard is there.
Taking notes?
Yes, he's the stenographer, basically. Yeah. And then when Cromwell says there are no charges, Thomas turns to him and says, "Take that down, Richard. There are no charges." Cromwell then tries to trick Thomas into admitting the king is not a higher authority than the church, but Thomas outmaneuvers him every single time. He brings up all this petty bullshit, like Thomas had some correspondence with a known heretic, and Thomas is like, "Yes, I was petitioning her to stop her behavior, and I have a copy of the letter I sent, and it's witnessed, so you can't get me on that." So Cromwell's just like, "Harumph," and then just moves on to the next petty charge. Finally, Cromwell outright asks if Thomas has any opinion on the king's marriage, and Thomas replies that he understood that he was not to be asked about that anymore. Cromwell leans back and says the king charges him with being very ungrateful, and there has never been so traitorous a subject as he. Thomas is then dismissed, and once he's gone, Richard asks what Cromwell will do now. "Whatever's necessary," says Cromwell. Cromwell, when he had that scene in the inn where Richard was giving him the information, Cromwell says that they are the administrators of the king, mm-hmm. and their duty is basically to do whatever the king wills them to do.
Yeah.
So, he is living up to that claim. Then we join Thomas outside, where none of the boatmen will give him a ride. Word passes quick. He is already persona non grata in the court. Can't even get a boat. The duke sees him and tells him he's dangerous to know. "Then don't know me," says Thomas. "But I do," says the duke. He pushes Thomas to give in, saying that he's just the son of a lawyer, and the royals are supposed to be the proud, arrogant ones, and they've all given in, so why can't he? It's disproportionate, he says. And also, during this, they're walking, and the duke, like, picks up a rock and throws it into the shadows, and a person scurries out and runs away, so there's just constant spying. Like, it's just relentless,
the
politicking. Then Thomas fakes an argument with the duke so anyone watching will think that they aren't allies anymore, and he, like, starts digging into him about caring more about the breeding of bulldogs than about any sort of religious conviction. And he says, like, "The royals would have slept through the Sermon on the Mount." And then he has this great line insulting the duke where he says, "Somewhere back in your pedigree, a bitch got over the wall."
Meaning what exactly? I wasn't sure what he meant by that.
He was talking about the breeding of bulldogs.
Yeah.
So he means the duke's pedigree is not as high and mighty as he would like. Like an unpedigreed bitch got over and impregnated one of the dogs. So it's not it's not as pure of a bloodline, right? The riffraff got in at some point. You are of lower station than you claim to be, sir.
Yeah.
Then we get a quick scene of Cromwell announcing to some council or other that the traitors in regards to the marriage must be caught, and then we're back with Thomas as he approaches his house under cover of darkness and strong winds. Another beautiful scene where he has these big trees on his estate and the wind is just making them sway and blow all their leaves. And I have no fucking idea what court Cromwell is talking to. They never tell you anything in this movie. They never tell you where you are or who is being addressed. It's like, well, of course you know the intricacies of the court of King Henry VIII. Who doesn't? You know where you are. Meg sees him and tells him the council is planning to force everyone to take an oath about the marriage, and it's treason if you don't take the oath. Thomas says that depending on the wording, he might actually be able to take it, and Meg should definitely take it regardless of what it says. Cut to Thomas being signed into the tower and the master of the tower telling him he has never been less happy about admitting a prisoner. So we just skip over him not taking the oath and just fast forward to the part. We all know where this is headed.
Yeah.
Thomas is in the tower.
Yeah.
Thomas is then left alone in his cell and goes to his window to watch children playing outside. And then we get a... This is the one part where I see what they're talking about with the cinematography, because we get a clever visual way of time passing where you just get the shot of the children playing next to the tree, and then time passes and it's just that same shot, but then the children vanish and then there's snow on the ground and snow on the tree, and then the snow vanishes and we're back to springtime, showing how long Thomas has been in the tower. Next, we see Thomas taken before a panel of the Duke, Cromwell, and some rando priest we've never seen before. I think this is the Archbishop we learn later, but they never tell us anything, so he's just there and you don't know who he is. And then all three of them try to make him speak against the king's marriage or accept it, but Thomas will do neither, and as punishment, Cromwell forbids him to have books or see his family anymore. They get into the most pedantic minutiae about what his opinions are, and the Archbishop is like, so what is it about the king's marriage that you disagree with? And Thomas says nothing. And the Archbishop's like, well, what is it you have an issue with? What is it that you is not favorable? They're just like trying to find the right term that will make him react.
And it's none of them.
And then Thomas says he like won't speak on the issue. And then they're like, aha, so your opinions are treasonous. And then Thomas's response is, they may be, but unless you actually hear them, you can't say anything definitively. It's all lawyer speak, and like, you don't have concrete proof, you're just working off assumptions, and like, everyone, including Thomas, is just exhausted by this whole thing, and they're like, they're so sick of it, because this is not the first time they have done this, and the Duke especially is just like, this is all bullshit, like, this is such a waste of time. Once Thomas leaves, the Duke complains that this has devolved into a farce, and Cromwell snaps back that the king is getting impatient and wants results. The Duke leaves, and Richard suggests that they torture Thomas to get the results. Richard has just gone all the way bad at this point. Cromwell declines, though. The king won't allow torture to get a confession. They have to go about it the right way. Yeah, it's such a weird thing where the king is willing to falsely imprison, but not falsely torture. Like,
but there's a big difference.
I suppose it feels like just a matter of scale at some point. Like, oh, you'll deny this man access to his family. That's not torture, but you won't physically torture him. Like, it's splitting hairs at a certain point.
No, there's a huge difference in what you're saying. Like, physical violence?
You're saying being kept away from me for over a year wouldn't be torture to you?
It was. I've lived it, so I know it is. I'm just saying, like, there's...
It's not the rack.
It's so different. Like, being falsely imprisoned is... It sucks, but if you're falsely imprisoned, you still have, like, a bed and here and some food, and you can survive and maybe have some hope that maybe at some point something's gonna change.
Yeah, they're not sticking splinters under your fingernails.
Yeah.
Yep. I get it.
I would rather be falsely imprisoned than be tortured physically.
I see. Next scene is Thomas getting a visit from his family, despite Cromwell saying he's not allowed to. And Meg tries to convince him to accept the marriage and has just as much luck as all the other people that have tried to do that. She actually has, like, prepared arguments about, like, well, it's an unjust society. Since you are a just man, you're being punished for being just. That proves that this is an unjust society, and why should you suffer for an unjust society? Mm. And then his response to that is, even if the entire world is corrupt, that doesn't relieve you for your responsibility from being a good person. And he says, we must stand fast, even at the risk of being heroes. Which, I like that line. Because he doesn't want to be a hero, it's just his conviction.
I wouldn't call it hero in this case, more like a martyr.
Yes. The jailer then tells them that they only have 2 more minutes, and they haven't even been in for 2 minutes, I don't think, at that point when he says that. And then Thomas tells his family they need to get the hell out of there, and he says goodbye to his wife. And I liked the goodbye between him and his wife a lot. I was well done. They brought him some food, and he sits down and starts eating it, and he's like, oh, I know who made this custard. It's such a good custard. And, oh, you're in such a beautiful dress. And when he says the thing about the custard, she has his back to him, and she's just like, she has some apples she's fiddling with in her hands, and he goes, I know who made this custard. And she goes, I made it. It was such a childish but human thing to say.
Yeah.
Like, it was... There's just, like, this edge of, like, petulance to it. Like, I made it. Like...
They're playful. That shows, like, despite her yelling at him earlier and scolding him for going against the king, like, it shows that they love each other. There's affection.
It's affection, but also, like, the British awkwardness of where they don't want to show their emotions, so she can't even look at him while she's saying it, and she's, like, nervously fidgeting with the apples. They did very well, or that actress did very well, being realistically, like, awkward and not wanting to show emotion.
Yeah.
And then she rounds on him and starts yelling and saying, like, she didn't want him to be a martyr, and she's angry at him for all of this, and she's afraid that after he dies, she's going to hate him for it. And then that really upsets him, and he's like, you have to understand. Like, you don't have to accept it, but he'll go to his death in agony if she tells him she doesn't understand what he's doing and why he has to do it. And then she does relent and says that he's the greatest man she's ever known, and they hug and have a good goodbye. And she, like, yells to the heavens, like, and if the king or anyone wants to know what I think of the marriage, all they have to do is ask. And then after she does that, he goes, oh, I married a lion. Yeah, they're cute together in the scene. That's the only time in the whole movie where they actually, like, show any affection for each other.
It was a good scene. It was well written. Well played, too.
Yep. And then we move to the trial. And the trial starts with a scene of Thomas praying in, like, the anteroom before the courtroom. And then someone comes in to fetch him, and the camera just follows him behind his back as he slowly walks into the courtroom. That was a good entrance scene.
Yeah.
Where you get to slowly... I think if it just snapped there, you'd lose some of the weight of the moment. But watching him... Because it's like a... It's almost like the kind of corridor you walk through when you're, like, walking to a boxing ring. It's very narrow, so the full size of the courtroom, like, dawns on you as you walk towards it.
Yeah.
And this is not, like, a modern courtroom, obviously. This is 1500, so there's, like... stadium seating on 3 sides of this pit, basically, that he's in. And then the 4th side, of course, is, like, the raised steps, and it's 3 people in priests, I guess, in red robes that look like Snuggies, sitting on the raised seats and presiding over the court. So Thomas is told by the Red Wizards that he's greatly offended the king, but if he renounces his obstinate opinion, he may still taste the king's mercy. Thomas replies that he would like a chair, because he's just standing. I'm so tired. He gets a chair, and then Cromwell reads the charges, which are that Thomas doesn't accept the king as head of the church. Thomas replies he never said that, he's just remained silent, and silence is no crime. Cromwell says that silence is a crime, and they argue about the meaning of obscure Latin phrases that have to do with silence. That's... So many of the conversations in this movie are, like, pedantic quabbling over minor philosophical points, and it's super well-written always, but also, like, there's a pointlessness to it, because you can tell no matter what Thomas says or whatever quality argument he's made.
It just doesn't matter.
Yeah, it doesn't fucking matter, because the king doesn't like what he's saying, and that's the only thing that actually matters, is that the king is angry.
It's like the, it reminded me about the movie...
Emile Zola?
Emile Zola.
Yeah, this is our second sham trial.
Yeah.
It's all for show. The quibbling over Latin phrases gets them nowhere, so Cromwell calls in Richard to testify about hearing Thomas say that Parliament didn't have the power to make the king more powerful than God. How dare he? The wizards are incensed! But Thomas stands and says, if it's true, then he prays he will never see the face of God, because Richard is lying about this.
Mm-hmm.
Is it probable, he says, that he would keep his silence so long and then open his mind to a man such as this? And he gestures at Richard, who now has, like, a chain of office and, like, fancy-ass robes. Because when he first appeared in the movie, he was dressed... like, the common folk.
Yeah.
But now he is a lord of the court. Right.
Well, he's been given some sort of, like, administrative position somewhere, too.
Yep. The wizards don't care, though, and Thomas accepts his fate. As Richard leaves, Thomas asks him what it profits a man to gain the whole world and lose his own soul. Richard has no answer. And you can... Richard...
because Richard has no soul.
Yes. He hesitates while he's giving his testimony, though. Like, Cromwell has to prompt him to keep going. Like, and he'll stutter, and you get close-ups of his face where he's clearly hesitating to condemn Thomas. And Cromwell has to be like, and then? Is that all he said, Richard? And then...
Oh, I didn't take it as hesitation as much as, like, he didn't remember the script. Like, and not, like, the actor didn't remember the script,
yeah.
Just, like, the Richard didn't remember what he was supposed to say to incriminate Thomas.
Yeah, he goes, line, line! No, I took that as hesitation, because this was, like, the last shred of conscience he has. Because I do believe that he genuinely cares for Thomas, it's just that he cares about his own personal station way more.
Yeah.
So he feels bad, but he still does it. It doesn't feel bad enough. The wizards then dismiss the jury to deliberate, but Cromwell says, considering the evidence, the jury shouldn't need to be dismissed. The jury agrees and says Thomas is guilty, as they were instructed to do, I'm sure. The wizards then begin to read out the sentence, but Thomas interrupts and says when he was a lawyer, the practice was to ask the condemned before sentencing if they had anything to say. The wizards ask if he has anything to say. He does. Since he has already been condemned, he will let the court know his feelings about the king being the head of the church. Get him, Thomas.
This is the time.
And I have the entire speech written down here. I will now read it verbatim. Thomas says, everything that guy just said is bullshit. No, I didn't actually write it down. He goes on about how Jesus is Lord and the Pope is the descendant of Christ and he has the real power. And then his finishing line is, but we all really know that this is about the marriage anyway, and that the court is in an uproar and the wizards are incensed when he says that. Yeah. And then Cromwell stands up and goes, I knew it! when he says that. I think the sham trial in The Life of Meazel was better than this one. I think he had a better speech. I think it was way more of a cartoonish farce in that one. I that was just an overall better trial. Not that this one is bad. It's just we've seen two trials and it's...
Yeah,
it's
the other one had more action to it.
Better speeches, better oration, more of a sham. This is just the lesser of the two. The sentence is then read. Thomas is guilty of high treason and will be executed. Cut to Thomas on the execution platform. He tips the executioner, which was wild. He hands him a coin.
Yep.
And this is the clearest sign that tipping culture is just out of control.
Not well paid that even the person who's about to whose head is about to get cut off needs to tip.
How about you pay your executioners a living wage? How about that? Ugh, late stage capitalism. Bleh.
This is one of those moments in the movie that made me genuinely laugh.
Though. Yeah, I was like, what the fuck? Like, okay, Thomas, we get it that you're virtuous, but now you're just fucking showing off. Like, tipping your executioner. Never have I ever even conceived of such a thing. Holy shit. So he does that, and then he kneels down, and then the Archbishop there, and there's some last quip about Thomas being like, and I'm going to God, and the bishop's like, are you sure, Thomas? And Thomas is like, yep, I'm pretty sure, because everyone else sucks.
He says something about, you know, the fact that he's always been
a loyal servant
to the king, yeah, but to God first.
Yes. He said, the king has commanded to be brief, and I am his loyal servant, and so I will obey. And then he's, yes, and let it be remembered that I was a loyal servant to the king, but foremost a loyal servant to God. Mm. And he kneels down, and the axe is raised, and comes down. Cut to black. They did a really good cut. As soon as you hear the thunk as it hits the wood, the screen just cuts to black.
Yeah.
That was a really nice touch. Then a narrator that we have never ever heard before tells us that Thomas's head was placed on Traitor's Gate for a month until Meg removed it and kept it until her death.
Yuck.
That's a insane detail that's just glossed over. Where did she keep it? Maybe I don't want to know. It's a conversation piece. Then the narration tells us, in one of the most unintentional bits of hilarity I've ever seen in a movie, that Cromwell was beheaded 5 years later for high treason himself, the archbishop was burned at the stake, and the king died of syphilis.
Everybody got what they deserve.
The end. Yes, that was... The end of this movie is one of the most hilarious endings, and by end, I mean literally like the last 7 seconds where it goes, oh, and by the way, 5 years later, everyone involved in this was dead. Like... just undercutting everything that just happened. Like,
yep.
None of this shit mattered. The archbishop was burned at the stake and the king died of syphilis. None of this mattered. None of it. Just revealing at the very end what a complete farce all of this was.
I mean, we already knew that this was a farce. It was just reinforced so much by the voiceover narration.
Yes, I got a good hard laugh out of that when we watched it. And the king died of syphilis. It did mention, And Bowling Lane also got her head chopped off. So
yeah.
This fucking lady he went through all this hoopla and rigmarole to marry fucking chopped her head off.
Yeah, because if I remember well, she also didn't give him a son.
Oh.
I might be wrong on that one, but he got her head chopped off.
God, everything about royalty and court life is just so stupid. And it's just compounding error upon compounding error. And I asked you this off mic because, like, why does anyone aspire to live in this world? Like, everyone is miserable, constantly backstabbing each other, and then you get to the highest position, and odds are within 3 years you're gonna have your damn head cut off. Like, why does anyone do this?
And I said, because at the time, in the 16th century, it was probably, as it isn't probably in any time of history, it's better to have some sort of like house and be able to feed yourself than to live on the streets and have nothing.
Yeah. I just,
people just choose to, you know, to save themselves.
Well, it still applies to modern life. I think about this, people who like chase status and power and wealth and like, they're never happy. Like, they're the most miserable, unhappy people. Like, and it's been true for, like, the entire history of our species, and, like, no one ever learns anything, and it's just a never-ending trap. It's just, like, in every age, in every season, there's always people just falling into that trap.
I don't disagree with you.
Why? We never learn anything. Why? The kings are miserable. They hate everything. Don't aspire to be them.
I don't disagree with you. It's just they're...
And if you work really hard, children, someday you too can die of syphilis. After chopping multiple of your wife's heads off. Living the dream. I'm sorry, what were you gonna say?
Doesn't matter.
Alright. Where is this going on your list? That matters. I have a request.
Okay.
I have a special request for this movie. This movie was so forgettable to me. Like, there's nothing particularly wrong with it, but there's just nothing that will make it stick in memory other than that absolutely fucking hilarious ending. I want to request that when we put this movie on our list, and you can do this too, audience, if you want to, and by audience I mean dad, because you're the only one playing along. Instead of putting the actual title on our lists, I would like to call this movie Plain White Rice. And then at the end of this podcast, when we are going down our list, to see if we can remember what the actual title of this movie is. Because it will just be Plain White Rice on our list.
Okay, but there are plenty of other movies that could be renamed that.
You're right.
So what is so special about this one?
It's just so aggressively bland. It's just so straightforward. You're right. The King's Speech, because I've seen that movie before and we're going to watch, that could also earn this title of Plain White Rice.
No, yes. The King's Speech was good. I was moved watching this King's Speech.
It wasn't bad, but see, it was just like bland as hell and super straightforward. Although maybe for me going into this movie, there's just no tension to it because I already knew it was going to happen. But there's no like twists or anything in this movie. It's always just people being like, bend the knee, Thomas, and him just going, no. It's just that for 2 hours.
Again, what's so special about that? What distinguishes this one from other plain white rice movies?
The level of plainness and whiteness and riceness. It's just like the poster child of like just movie the movie. Like, it's so forgettable and just, it's just a nothing movie.
Alright, I'm not gonna argue.
Yeah, just humor me.
I will.
Humor me.
I will humor you.
Put it and see if it left enough of an impression on us to where we can even remember the title once we're at the end of this project. So where is Plain White Rice going on your list?
Oh boy.
Is it better than Mutiny on the Bounty?
Where's Mutiny on the Bounty?
22 out of 38.
No.
Is it better than Grand Hotel?
No.
Marty?
No.
All About Eve?
No.
Ha! Was it greater than The Greatest Show on Earth? I didn't see any clowns in this movie.
I'm gonna put this between... Oh boy, do I want to put it between My Fair Lady and The Apartment or The Apartment and Gentleman's Agreement?
This is going to be in the 30s then.
Yeah.
The bottom portion.
I'm gonna put it between My Fair Lady and The Apartment, so it's gonna be my new number 31.
Yeah.
Yeah, that seems about right.
It's offensively inoffensive.
Although, no, I'm gonna put it above My Fair Lady. This movie was better than My Fair Lady.
Yeah, less misogyny and period appropriate misogyny. Plain White Rice, your new number 30. And movie in all caps.
Yep. Okay, where are you putting it on your list?
Oh boy. Well, we've already established that The Life of Emile Zola was better than this, and that's my 19, so it's got to go below that. Is it better than The Apartment? I don't think so. Better than An American in Pelly? Sure. So, for me, in between American in Paris and The Apartment, making it my new number 27. Just too bland, just too dry. Just too many pedantic conversations about Latin and, like...
I have a question, though. If at the end of this podcast, we write down our lists and we actually remember what this movie is, does it get to move?
No.
So it will still stay in the same place, even if we remember it.
Yeah. It's just a test of our memory. This is carved in stone.
Okay.
Not even King Henry VIII could change this list. Yeah. Just try.
Yeah, just nothing inherently bad about it.
But nothing inherently good either.
Or... yeah, nothing super interesting, entertaining. Definitely some good quotes.
Yeah, very well written, but it's just stuffy and very like high society. And oh, this is a critic's movie.
It's one of the issues I have with most biopics, as like, I'm not entirely sure why my reaction is that way with this. I love reading autobiographies and autofictions and stuff like that, but as a movie genre, I don't know, it's not as entertaining to me.
Yeah, I agree. But our next movie, we're finally going back to America, right?
The next movie is called In the Heat of the Night.
In the Heat of the Night, yep. I think it's some sort of crime movie.
I think so.
Set in Chicago, maybe?
I'm not entirely sure about where. I know it's definitely a crime movie.
It's set somewhere in America. We're finally going back. We're
coming back.
Across the pond to finish out the decade. At long last. I'm looking forward to it. I'm tired of this burying our head in the sand and like, let's talk about European royalty from 500 years ago. Crap. Let's see what's going on right here, right now, in America. God damn it.
Yep.
Anything else to say?
No.
Yep. Yeah. Oh, thanks everybody for listening.
I'll see you next time.
Yeah. Bye.
Bye.
Okay, that's it.